At a time when the credit crisis and bank bailouts are dominating the news, Margaret Atwood provides us with an entirely unexpected perspective on debt. Her new book, Payback, Debt and the Shadow Side of Wealth, explores the subject as one of the most powerful themes in literature, the basis of religion, the impetus for memory, and the origin of storytelling. Ms. Atwood, winner of the Booker Prize for her novel, The Blind Assassin, is the best-selling author of more than 35 books of poetry, fiction, and nonfiction. Payback is published by the House of Anansi Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought her back to the show today. Hello.
Hello.
This book turns out to be incredibly timely, but I'm assuming that you began working on it long before there was any warning of an impending global economic crisis.
And that is true. I had to plan it out 3 years ago. There was a sort of an impending warning. In fact, I wrote a piece called Letter to America in 2003, just before America went into the Iraq War, in which I said, you're going to dig yourself into a great big hole of debt, which is, in fact, what has happened. But this kind of meltdown, the one where we just started having this fall in a big scale, I wasn't expecting that to happen when it did, and I did not do it as a promo for my book.
You're not responsible. I was looking for someone to blame. You point out that in Aramaic, the word for sin also means debt. So what's the relationship between those two concepts? Because they don't mean the exact same thing today, or do you think that they do?
Well, I came to it through that, the fact that there are two translations for that word when people do the Lord's Prayer. One says, forgive us our trespasses, and one says, forgive us our debt. So I thought, how did that come about? And it turns out that they were connected in the original word. I would say that debt becomes sinful, that is, harmful to other people, when you can't pay it back, and then there's a domino effect, which is, in fact, one of the themes of 19th century novels. What happens when somebody goes crashing down in debt? The fallout that happens to other people. And we have been watching that domino effect these days. You think, well, some guy on Wall Street goes down in flames, and you think, well, serves him right. But then you think of all the people who had jobs through that company, and then all of the other people who had jobs through those people who had jobs, and it just extends.
That's what's happening now in the debate over the automobile manufacturers.
Who's going to be hurt? That's when it becomes sinful. It's when it hurts other people.
But it's not just money. You talk about other kinds of debt.
Exactly. And in fact, the foundation on which our whole borrowing and lending of money thing is based, and money is a very, very recent human invention. We made it up. But there is a basis a lot more ancient than that. And that's the kind of social trading we do all the time. For instance, if I say good morning to you, I have lent you a good morning. If you do not pay me back with a reciprocal good morning, I'll feel, what's the matter with him? What did I do? Why is he so grumpy? Why is he being so mean? I feel that I'm owed a good morning. And that goes, in fact, back to primates who do this kind of social trading a lot. There's just a study out that says that you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, is literally true among chimpanzees. They trade back scratchings.
And so they pick out lice from their fur.
That's lice picking. They trade lice picking, too, back scratching. You can't actually reach your own back very well, so it helps to have somebody. So we are social beings, and we do this kind of social trading all the time. If we didn't, we could never have debt and credit.
Well, there's actually that line, you scratch my back, I'll
exactly.
scratch yours.
And it's based on something real.
But you say there's also spiritual debt and debts of honor.
Absolutely, and those cannot be repaid by money. Major religions of all kinds have afterlives in which good is repaid with good and bad is repaid with bad, particularly if that hasn't happened in your life on earth. So we like to feel that the scales are evened out somehow. It's all about balance and fairness.
You say that the whole of Christianity rests on the idea of spiritual debt.
Absolutely.
Are we talking about original sin here?
Well, we are in the whole debt package that we're talking about. We're talking about the fact that your debt here goes the concept. Your debt that you have inherited, and we do inherit debts, it says that in people's wills, heirs and assets, you have inherited a great big package of original sin debt that you cannot possibly pay off by yourself because it's too big. So your soul is in a kind of pawn shop, and along comes a redeemer. And we use the same word for pawn shop transactions. You redeem your watch out of the pawn shop, and your soul gets redeemed. Someone pays the debt for you. Get your soul out of hock.
So Jesus there paid is the that. Debt.
That's the idea. But it's not alone in that religion. There's Buddha does a similar kind of thing in the form of a rabbit, as I recall.
But don't you think that original sin is designed to be unpayable?
No, it has to be. Well, it's unpayable by you, but it's payable in the grand scheme of things. Just as, for instance, if you had put your watch into the pawn shop and you found that you couldn't quite manage to scrape together enough to get it out, and your friend came along and said, I'll do that for you, then you won't lose your watch. But then, of course, you owe your friend.
When we look back into the earliest signs of borrowing and lending in human history, are we seeing the same sorts of things we're seeing with primates? Or when did other organized means of borrowing and lending occur?
Very early. So early that we don't even know quite how early. But as soon as there were city-states in Mesopotamia and written down laws, you get the Code of Hammurabi, and there's a big chunk of stuff about debt. If you'd run up a big debt, you couldn't pay it off. You could sell the wife and kids.
There were major penalties.
Yes, wife and kids, or yourself. You could sell yourself into slavery.
Wow.
Or your courtesans, or you know anybody that you have, or your own slaves. You could sell people to get, and that still goes on. There is still debt slavery going on in the world today, particularly in India, where people run up such great big debts they can't pay them off. So the kids have to go out and work it off.
And then there were debtors' prisons later. It's always been treated rather harshly until fairly recently.
Yeah, debtors' prisons were an idea that didn't work very well because you got put in prison for not having any money and you couldn't get out until you paid off the debt. And while you were in there, you had to pay your own room and board. And what did that add up to? Well, either your wife and kids, as usual, went out to work for you, a rich relative came along and paid you off, or you gradually starved to death.
Well, these harsh punishments seem innately unfair, don't they?
Well, some of them seem unfair, but unless there is some penalty and unless there is a time, a date stamp on the debt, of course, nobody would ever pay anything off at all because they wouldn't have to.
My guest is Margaret Atwood. Her latest book is called Payback, Debt and the Shadow Side of Wealth. It's published by Anansi. Well, trust is an aspect to this whole thing, isn't it?
Absolutely, it's an aspect. And I think this is one of the things that has happened recently is that people lost faith. They lost the ability to credit. And we get this, that's what credit comes from. It means, I believe, credo. So they lost their ability to believe in the system because they felt it had not been fair. And in fact, it had not been fair because it had been putting strange toxic debts into nice shiny packages and putting snake oil labels on and selling them as good, fun things to own.
But I suspect this is not new. The Bible tells us that it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of the needle than for a rich man to get into heaven, which would suggest that people got rich. At least it was assumed that people got rich because they were doing something that was unfair.
In those times, the people who got particularly rich were called, when I read the Bible, it said publicans and sinners. And as a child, and until in fact quite recently, I always thought the publicans were guys who ran the pubs. In fact, they
That's
weren't.
You grew up in a country that was a British colony.
Maybe. Yeah, well, they didn't run the pubs. They were the tax collectors. And in the times of that Roman Empire, the tax collectors were involved in something called tax farming, in which they bid on the rights to do the tax collecting. They paid the amount that they had bid on to the Romans, and then they collected as much as they wanted to from the poor peasants. They ground the poor and extracted money from them. So they were quite bad people.
Well, in the early Catholic Church, it was considered a sin to amass money, especially if you were doing it through usury.
It was a sin to charge something called interest. Now, people got around that because they always somehow do. For instance, among the Muslims, it's not permitted to charge interests, but you can charge a transaction fee, something else that isn't called interest. And in fact, that's how people in those days got around it. The Knights Templar, for instance, were big money lenders, and they didn't charge interest, but you could charge rent on land. So they charged rent on money. They just called it something else.
But also it was a reason that Jews were the designated money lenders, at least until John Calvin came along. And it's the basis for plays like The Jew of Malta and The Merchant of Venice.
That's right. They were forced into money lending because nobody else was officially allowed to charge interest. So it was very convenient to have people who would do it.
But it's interesting that the wrong lender is the bad guy in those plays. Did trust go out the window if the lender wasn't of one's faith?
Well, you know, it's a very funny thing about borrowing and lending. At the moment when somebody lends us the money, we think they're a really good guy. 5 minutes afterwards, we think they're bad because we think they're going to have the temerity to demand that we pay it back. The Merchant of Venice is a very, very interesting study for lots of reasons, one of them being that all of the things you thought about Shylock turn out, when examined, not to be true. He's not actually a miser. If he were, he would have taken the 3 times the sum offered payback, but he refuses that. For him, it's a debt of honor, and debts of honor cannot be paid with money. And it is a debt of honor because he has been so badly treated
ahead
of
the
play.
And
he gets screwed in the end. Exactly. It's a very odd play.
Well, you're right that there's no debt without a story.
That's true, because a debt is the story of you before the debt, the moment when you got into it, what you did when you were in there, and then the story of how you got out of it or didn't get out of it. It's either a happy ending or a sad ending.
And often the people in debt are treated rather sympathetically, at least in 19th century novels, whether we're talking about Dickens or Emma Bovary or Faust.
Well, sometimes. Sometimes they're not, actually. Sometimes those debt stories in the 19th century, and there are a lot of them, partly because it was the age when capitalism was ballooning and nobody really quite understood it, and there were boom and bust cycles and people could lose their fortunes. And if you did lose your fortune, there was no social safety net. You just sank.
So that's why Dickens wrote so much about debt, because it was a reflection of his times, also a reflection of his own personal history.
Yes, poor Charles. His father was a feckless individual who got put in debtor's prison when Charles was 12, and Charles was sent out to work in a blacking factory and thought his life was over. And he was very worried about money from that time forward. So Scrooge, and his most famous character, arguably, is two sides of Dickens. The miserly one who was so worried about ending up in debtor's prison that he watched every penny, and then the generous, jovial one that he liked to present to the world. But he was both of them.
I mentioned earlier that this is also, debt is also an impetus for memory. How does that work?
Well, of course, there is no debt if there is no memory. Because if you can't remember if somebody owes you something, then the debt doesn't exist, because you will not remember that they ought to pay you back.
So account ledgers were kept from a very early point, the minute people started lending something?
As soon as we had a method of writing things down, that's what we wrote down, because it's a lot easier to remember stories than it is to remember numbers. So those early Mesopotamian records are pretty much accounting records. But of course, the corollary of that is that when the peasants revolted, which they have done from time to time when they felt they were being screwed too heavily by the tax collectors, one of the first things they liked to do was burn the record books, wipe out the debt.
Just one more. And when they did that, what happened to the people who owed the money? Weren't they screwed?
The people who were owed the money, the people that whose records got burnt. Well, quite often they got burnt too.
I see.
Yes, it was a sort of all-in thing, but you headed for the record books first, and then you like to annihilate anybody who could remember that you owed them money.
We have very little time, but I just want to deal with the whole matters of the matter of criminals paying their debt to society. You think that we should rethink that?
I think we should rethink it if our motives are going to be economic, you know, what it costs and what you get out of it. We say the criminal pays the debt to society, but in fact it isn't the criminal who pays anything. The taxpayer pays for having the criminal in jail. The only motive for doing that is not economic. It's a vengeance thing, unless, of course, you're putting people in jail who really would be harmful.
Yeah, you want to keep the rapists off
around.
The streets.
Absolutely, but a lot of other people are in there just because we think they should be. And if we examine our motives very far, it comes down to vengeance.
So what would you have us do with them?
Well, I don't know. It depends on how harmful they are.
Continue to burglarize our homes?
No. If they're harmful, of course, they should be kept from doing harm. But if they're not harmful, if they've done simply a nice white-collar crime, such as embezzling millions of dollars, they could be put into community service of some kind. They're not going to murder anybody.
Margaret Atwood is the winner of the Booker Prize, the Scotia Bank Giller Prize, the Governor General's Literary Award, among many other honors, author of 35 books of one sort or another. I don't want to go through the whole list. International Vice President of Penn.
And whatnot.
And one of her whatnots right now. This book, a kind of a mixture of history and literary history.
And jokes.
And philosophy and jokes,
yes,
and everything.
Only,
well, always jokes with you,
the only
Margaret.
Funny thing you're going to read about this subject.
Payback, Debt and the Shadow Side of Wealth. It is published by Anansi, and I thank you so much for being with us again.
And thank you.
Thank you.